Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And we have a thought-provoking show for you today.
That's right. We're going to be hearing from philosopher and theologian Ken Samples, biochemist Fuzzle Rana, and Justin Brierley of Premier Christian Radio.
And they're going to be addressing topics such as apologetics in our cultural context, are predator-prey relationships a result of the fall, and beauty as an argument for God.
Definitely thought-provoking.
Yes. First, and pretty.
Yes. First up is Culture Talk. Sandra's going to be interviewing RTB visiting scholar Pat McGuire as they discuss what does the Bible say about the flood. Let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we discuss culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. I'm joined today with Pat McGuire. You are an RTB visiting scholar, and we are going to be talking about a pretty hot topic, and that is the extent of Noah's flood. So my question is, when we're looking at the flood and we're looking at the biblical account of Noah's flood, what would we expect to see, geological records? What would we see if the flood were global, that is covering the entire earth with water?
Okay, if you're gonna cover the entire earth with water, then you're going to see deep water marine sediments over the entire planet. And you're not going to see lots of other depositional systems, but it will be deep water deposits virtually everywhere.
Okay, so now what would we expect from the other interpretation, which is that the flood was local and that it covered a smaller area of the surface of the earth in water? What would we see in the geological records?
Well, what we actually see in the geological record is we have a broad variety of depositional systems all around the planet. So, for example, if you go to Canyonlands in Utah, you see incised valleys, which are rivers flowing across the Colorado Plateau and etching out these deep canyons. If you go again to Utah and you go to Zion National Park, you see some of my favorite outcrops, which is the Navajo sandstone, which are these 1,000, 2,000 foot tall cliffs. And they are essentially fossilized sand dunes. So think of the biggest sand dunes you've ever seen in the Sahara Desert. These guys were every bit as big. So this is a depositional system, deep desert, that doesn't have any water at all. So what you see around the world is some river deposits, some deep desert deposits, lots of limestone, which is shallow marine environments. So you see a lot of different kinds of depositions all around the planet. So if the flood was limited in extent, that makes sense. If the flood is global in extent, then you really wouldn't expect to see what we actually see in the geologic record.
So the geologic record then shows that if there were a flood, it would be local in extent, and we aren't seeing any scientific evidence for a global flood. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
So kind of a concern then that some Christians would have is, sure, the scientific data may or may not point to a local or global flood, but surely the Bible only allows for one interpretation. So in looking at the Genesis creation account and looking at the flood account, does it allow for an interpretation other than a global flood?
Well, I think it not only allows for it, I think that's actually a better interpretation.
Okay, how
one,
so?
Well, one of my favorite observations, and I'm not the first guy that's made this observation, but in Genesis 8, it says that the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. Not the mountain, but the mountains. And then after a little bit, I think it's a week or so, then the tops of the mountains around became visible. And then Noah sends out the dove, and she flies around and she comes back because it says she found no place to rest the sole of her feet, for water covered all of the surface of the earth. The exact same wording. But all of the surface of the earth, well, the ark is on a mountain, and Noah's looking around and seeing all these mountains. So clearly, when it said all the surface of the earth, that's not the globe. That was from the point of view of the dove. She couldn't get to those other mountains over there. But And so that was all the surface of the earth to her, but Noah could see the mountains.
See the tops.
So clearly we have to be smarter than just all the surface of the earth means the entire planet, because I don't think the Bible allows that as a legitimate interpretation.
So we have the scientific data pointing to a local flood, and the biblical account really leaning toward a local flood interpretation as well. And something that I think non-Christians might push back against is this idea of a global flood, because they'll say there's not enough water. So it seems like having a local flood interpretation would also help us to engage in conversation with non-Christians about the legitimacy of this account and therefore kind of biblical accuracy. How would you use that to have a conversation with a non-Christian?
Well, I agree with your thought that if you had enough water to cover Mount Everest, then where did all the water go? Because in Genesis 8, it said it recedes, and it receded steadily, and it kept on receding. So it's receding, it's going somewhere. And if you've got water covering the top of Mount Everest, where does it go? So I think it's much easier to have a conversation with maybe a skeptical person if you have a localized flood as opposed to a global flood.
Thank you so much for that. If you want to hear more on this topic, go to reasons.org and search the Genesis flood. Now we're going to head to a Nexus segment. We'll hear from Justin Brierley as he talks about apologetics in our cultural context. Let's check it out.
I think the greatest apologetic challenge in our culture today is actually whether the church has answers for this generation. I think a lot of people, unfortunately, now associate, especially in the West and perhaps most especially in America, the church with basically a certain moralistic view of life, a certain political persuasion even. And I think a lot of people have failed to see any longer the central truths of Christianity, the claims of Christ. And what they see is people who are out basically to get their way politically, to, you know, campaign on some particular kind of moral issue. And I think that is a huge apologetic challenge in a way, because essentially the task for the Christian is to try and point people back towards Jesus and say, actually, we're not here simply to be another arm of government or part of some kind of political struggle. We're actually here to talk of another kingdom that goes beyond all of those issues. Now, that may work itself out in some ways that are political in the end. But how do we change the narrative? How do we stop ourselves simply being another warrior in the culture wars? Can we move beyond that? I think that is probably the most pressing issue I see, because people aren't even going to get to the question of who is Jesus? Did he rise from the dead? And that kind of thing. If they just think actually the church is just another part of, you know, all of the people who are warring for their attention in this world of, you know, political ideologies. So we've got to get back to what the church actually is and how it looks distinct from the culture around us, and that we don't just get mistaken as another power struggle in the world.
To hear more from our friend Justin Brierley, go check out his podcast called Unbelievable. Now it's time for RTB 101, and this is where we help to train you to share your faith more effectively. And here once again to help us talk about a very important question that many of our young earth creationist friends raise is Dr. Fuzz Rana. Welcome back, Fuzz.
Good to be with you, Krista.
You know, Fuzz, many of my Christian friends who are young earth creationists, they often have a concern about an issue called animal death before the fall. Maybe you can start by telling us a little bit more about that concern and where it comes from.
Yeah, well, when you look at the fall of human beings that's described in Genesis 3, you see as a consequence of that fall that human beings died spiritually, that we were separated from God as a result of Adam and Eve's rebellion. And as a consequence, Adam and Eve also not only died spiritually, but ultimately physically, because they were denied access to the tree of life. And so many young earth creationists, in fact, many Christians would argue that as a result of Adam's fall, death entered into creation. And this included not only death for human beings, but death for animals and plants as well. And so they see a change in the cosmos as a result of the fall. And they struggle to envision a world that they would call good where there was animal death prior to the fall. And so they argue that to say that death entered into the creation as part of the original creation would essentially impugn God's character. How could God be good? How could the creation be good if animals would suffer and would experience pain and then ultimately die?
Thanks. That's very helpful. Now, one of the things that I'm thinking about is that Reasons to Believe, we are old earth creationists, so we accept the conventional age for the earth. So when we go out into the record of nature, maybe you can describe what kind of evidence that we see for animals dying before humans.
Yeah, well, if you are an old earth creationist, then you accept the fact that there has been life present on earth for 3.8 billion years. And that means there's also been death that has been part of earth and life's history as well for 3.8 billion years. And the evidence for this is, first of all, the fossil record that clearly shows life being present for this period of time. But we also see things in the fossil record like mass extinction events that are oftentimes coupled to mass origination events. But nevertheless, we do see these instances where environmental catastrophes triggered the loss of huge amounts of plant and animal species on the planet. But then we also see huge amounts of biodeposits, things like coal, natural gas, tar, oil. The amount of these deposits is incredibly vast, and these are deposits that are derived from the decayed from organisms that died and then underwent a decay process. And the vast amount of biodeposits is so extensive, there's no way you could account for it through the result of some kind of recent global flood that happened only a few thousand years ago. So the preponderance of evidence indicates that life has been present on Earth and that death has been part of life's history on Earth for 3.8 billion years.
So that leads me to the next question, which I know is a question of concern for many of my Christian friends. And that is, what does the Bible say? Because the Bible is our authority. So does it have anything to say about animal death before the fall of Adam and Eve? Is that seen as evil? Is there even any connection between Adam's sin and animal death?
Yeah, well, I mean, as an old earth creationist, I would, like my young earth brothers and sisters, affirm that as a result of the fall, human beings died spiritually, we died physically, that the fall introduced into the creation human death. But there's absolutely nothing in scripture that says that there was no animal death prior to the fall. In fact, you actually see the opposite being taught in scripture. For example, there are passages like Psalm 104 or Job 38 and 39. These are all creation accounts where God is being praised for his work as creator. And in all of these accounts, we see God being described as being responsible for creating predator-prey relationships, for creating carnivores, for providing prey for the predators, and that God is celebrated and to be worshiped because of that. That is, it looks as if animal death was part of the original creation and is part of the good creation. And so the scriptural evidence indicates that animal death was part of the original creation and that we should understand it as being good, not evil or not the result of the fall.
Why is this discussion about animal death before the fall important when we're talking to non-Christians? How does it help me engage them in a conversation about faith?
Well, one reason why many people reject the Christian faith or reject belief in God in a more general sense is because they, like young earth creationists, struggle to see how God could be good and also at the same time create a world where there's animal pain and suffering and animal death. And that's why it's really important for us to have a robust philosophical and theological approach to issues like animal death, and to recognize that maybe there is a good reason why God would create a world where animal death is part of it. And I think studies in ecology very quickly or very easily and readily demonstrate that if it wasn't for animal death, ecosystems wouldn't be stable, biodiversity would not be as extensive as it is. So animal death does serve a necessary and good purpose. But it's very important that we have responses to this challenge, because this keeps many people away from embracing belief in God and ultimately embracing the gospel.
Well, thanks, Fuzz. And I do want to invite all of our viewers to check out Fuzz's blog, The Cells Design, at reasons.org. Next up, we're going to hear from our staff theologian and philosopher, Kenneth Samples, and he's talking about beauty as an argument for God. Let's check it out.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink, and welcome back to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas to help you be more confident in the truth of Christianity. And today I'm joined again by my friend and colleague, Ken Samples, and we're going to look at the idea of beauty and whether that points to a God or not. Ken, good to have you back on the show.
Hi, Jeff.
So it's a little bit of a diversion from, you know, scientific studies and what does the evidence say, but just kind of look at the idea of beauty and is that an argument we can use for God? And so I guess I'll just throw the question first to you. How would you define beauty? What are we talking about when we talk about this idea of beauty?
Yeah, this is known as the aesthetic argument. The study of aesthetics relates to beauty, taste, and art. It asks questions like, what is beauty? How do we define it? Where did it come from? Is it merely in the eye of the beholder? So it has a number of questions, but I think it's very relevant because part of a person's worldview is a collection of values, and beauty would be one of those important values.
So, I mean, in terms of, you know, when you talk about a beginning or the cosmological or the teleological, you're talking about a beginning and design. That seems more quantifiable, tangible. I could put some hard things behind that. How would you say, how would we go about establishing there's beauty, or how would you define it or measure it, if you will?
Well, I would say, first of all, that beauty, people know it when they see it. I mean, when I take walks in the evening with my wife, we look at the sunset, and my wife is taken by it. She sees something there that grips her, and I do too. I think that when we look at a worldview, we ask the question, why is there so much beauty in the world? Why is the world beautiful? And what's the best explanation of that? I mean, from an atheist worldview, I think probably the only thing that could be said is that maybe beauty had some survival advantage, but that's difficult to understand how beauty could enhance civilization. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if God is not only an engineer, not only a creator, but he is also a playful and skillful artist, then beauty is part of God. In fact, Christians talk about the beatific vision. When we see God, we will encounter the ultimate beauty.
You know, I find this discussion interesting because, you know, when you things that come to mind when I think of beauty are maybe majestic landscapes or art or incredible, structures, architecture, if you will. But even in the sciences, there are models and ideas and hypotheses that are talked about as being beautiful, or the equations are beautiful. I mean, Maxwell's equations are remarkable because of how succinctly they're symmetric, they're succinct, and they describe this great wealth of phenomena, if you will. Yeah. And so, you know, it seems a little bit hard to quantify, but it also seems very pervasive, if you will. And that seems to be kind of part of your argument, is that there's a lot of beauty around.
There is a lot of beauty in the world. And when I talk with non-Christians who maybe don't believe in God, they don't go to church, but they'll go to an art museum and they're moved by it. They're taken by it. A big part of their pleasure and fulfillment in life is in experiencing beauty. And you're right. I mean, our colleagues, Hugh Ross, Dave Rogstad, I mean, you mentioned an equation. They see the elegance, the unity, the simplicity of that. Where does that come from? Why is the universe the way it is? Does it require an artist the way the universe requires an engineer?
You know, this is interesting, and I'll throw this out to get your comments on it, that when physicists are looking for, you know, what do we know about the world? We've got these laws of physics, gravity, electromagnetism, strong and weak nuclear forces, that we think all of those are unified into one fundamental force, and there's a beauty and an elegance in that, that there's this unity and simplicity that gives rise to diversity and complexity. that to me reminds me of, in some sense, God, that there's a unity and simplicity, but there's also a diversity and complexity in the Trinity, if you will.
Yeah.
So is this something more than just a neat analogy, or am I just being hopeful and optimistic here?
No, I mean, I think a powerful way of thinking about the Trinity is referring to the universe. The universe is unity and diversity. The Trinity provides that. The Trinity provides love. The Trinity provides beauty in that kind of context. And I think, Jeff, it's underutilized. I mean, we live in a world and in a society that puts maximum value on beauty. You know, we like to present cosmological arguments, moral arguments, teleological arguments. Why can't we speak to people who prize beauty and say that beauty makes the best sense in a world made by the biblical God?
You know, I'm sympathetic, but I could imagine if I go and give that sort of argument, you know, some of the pushback that I would give to it is, you know, it seems like there's a, you know, I mean, you can say, okay, people, defining beauty is a little bit hard. So what some person considers beautiful, another person would not consider beautiful. Isn't beauty just kind of subjective, almost, you know, something we could have almost invented, if you will, to describe this euphoric chemicals that are running through our brain, if you will?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that there is a subjective element in our engaging beauty, but it's, you know, it's difficult to meet anyone who doesn't prize beauty. Beauty seems to be a very important part of what it means to be human. And I think we can draw that and say, I know it when I see it, and I wonder how to best account for it. Is it merely an evolutionary thing where, you know, colorful birds attract a mate? I don't think beauty can best be explained that way. I think our world has an abundance of beauty. Things I see, beauty in music, beauty in all kinds of ways. I think God is the great artist.
You know, I think that's an interesting point, especially when you contrast Earth with some of the other planets around. Is, you know, you see greens and reds and yellows and blues and contrasts. And, you know, we've got capability of going and photographing Mars and Venus. And they're very monotonic. There's not a lot of structure and color to them, if you will. And so I think that is a remarkable thing of just how much beauty there is here on Earth. I guess in my question in there, you know, you made a comment that everybody seems to be drawn to beauty or see beauty in something. Right. Is that something kind of like hope, where, you know, people have talked about, if you don't have hope, you're not going to be able to survive? Is it something that if we don't see beauty, or if we don't have something that we hold beautiful, that's going to dramatically diminish our life?
Well, I certainly think it enhances it. I mean, I've never met anyone who doesn't like, you know, art or music, someone who isn't moved by this. It seems to be more than just, you know, something on the side. It seems to be part, a necessary part of human flourishing. And in that way, I would again ask, is it the product of evolution? I think that's a hard fit. But there's so much beauty. It's so important to us. Could it be part of the created order? I think that makes more sense, at least to me.
Thanks, Ken. I appreciate your comments. You know, when we look at creation, it does seem to be, everybody recognizes that there is just an amazing amount of beauty, whether it's the design in the cell, whether it's the majestic landscapes, whether it's the simplicity of the equations that describe it all. We see beauty and we crave and desire to understand it and appreciate it. You know, I would encourage you to go to reasons.org and check out Ken's blog article on this. It's called God is the Best Explanation for Beauty, to help you understand this maybe a little bit slippery argument, but nonetheless a powerful argument that points to the God of the Bible being the creator of it all.
That does it for us this week. We hope this episode has helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And don't forget, subscribe to the show and search for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show.
We also have the podcast version of 2819 available anywhere you listen to podcasts. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.